three-pointer. Bang! Tie game with 5 seconds left. 5 seconds
left in the game.
Over.
You believe in miracles? Yes!
White is the new gold.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Announcer's Journal. I'm your host, Todd Harris. This week, one of my all-time favorites, a four-time Olympic medal winner, politician in his past lives, we'll get to that, and the pride of Trinidad and Tobago, the voice of NBC Track and Field, the one and only Otto Bolden. Otto, how are you, my friend?
I am doing quite well, quarantining and social distancing like everybody else.
What have you been doing to keep busy? I mean, I know you do a lot of training, you do a lot of speaking, but in this pandemic time, what have you been doing to stay busy?
I found myself on Instagram Live quite a bit, doing thousands, it seems like, of Zoom calls. And I mean, I had a chance to lecture to Columbia University. So
wow.
I've been trying to keep busy. I've also had my training going on. I'm still training Brianna Williams, who is an Olympic hopeful for Jamaica. And apart from that, I have been watching every single piece of footage that there is on YouTube, because yeah. I feel like I want to come out of this a better announcer. So I've looked back at footage back when the reaction time threshold for the 100, for example, was 0.12. So I feel like I've done a good job of educating myself even more as a broadcaster.
Speaking of doing a good job, last week we had Rowdy Gaines on the show, and he is so good at breaking down splits and relays and knowing exactly the times. And you're kind of the same way. You have kind of a photographic memory of what someone ran in Berlin in 98 and this and that. You can equate quickly how you think they're going to fare. You've immersed yourself so much into track and field at this point. What's the next level? Where can you take it even more to get more inside for the fans on a track and field meet?
It's interesting that you would ask that now, because we are in discussions now. Tokyo 2021 is going to be the first track Olympics where Olympic track and field competition where they have the microchips and the bibs. Mm. That gives us the ability to convey, to receive and therefore convey information that we've never had before. So we're talking about how would we want in a perfect world to be able to show, you know, for example, a 100-meter dash to the viewer with extra information. Like, would I want to be able to say, hey, Christian Coleman hit 40 meters first, he hit a higher top speed, and he didn't decelerate at the end, and that's why that gap that he created in the first 30, you know, he was able to maintain right. it through the finish line. So it's going to be an exciting time for me as somebody who, yes, I'm into numbers, but I also have to stay on the side of, look, there are people who watch the Olympic track and field venue that don't watch track and field every 4 years. But I think the information that we're gonna have access to is gonna enable me and everybody else in the booth to do things we've never seen before.
So taking your inside information, because I know you're always in the know, will Tokyo happen next summer?
I think it will. And I was really about 50-50, maybe about 5 or 6 weeks ago. The more I talk to sort of the powers that be, mm-hmm. the people who, you know, can't go officially on record, but, you know, are telling me, yes, we feel very confident. I am about maybe 90% sure that Tokyo 2021 will in fact happen.
So that sets in motion a lot of other things that have to happen. The U.S. national trials, obviously the Olympic team has to be named. The world championships, do they get pushed? How does this all factor into the track and field schedule? Because it's a busy schedule.
Yeah, it is a very busy schedule. I think the most concerning thing for next year is all the meets that are on schedule, because next year, the European Championships have to happen, and the Commonwealth, excuse me, that'd be in 2022, but in 2021, we were supposed to have Worlds. That actually creates a problem in 2022 when you have European Championships, Commonwealth Games, and the World Championships. So next year, if we can just get the Olympics off, that'll be fine. I think it will create a little bit of an issue in the next year.
And that takes me to my next question with you. As I mentioned at the top of the show, you're a four-time Olympic medalist, countless national championships, world championships. You've been at all the meets and around the world and some great venues. What is the greatest track and field venue of all time, in your opinion?
Wow, greatest track and field venue of all time. I think the greatest track venue I've been in is the Sydney Olympic Stadium for 2000. You're talking about 100,000+ people, that atmosphere for the night of right. Kathy Freeman, that's to me the pinnacle. But a very close second is London 2012. That night when Mo Farah wins and they win the long jump and they win the heptathlon, I don't think I've ever been in any stadium anywhere on the planet that was that loud. And having put those two as my top two, I think that Eugene and what they're building at the University of Oregon, from every I haven't seen it in person yet.
You've seen the drawings and the photos.
Yeah, the early videos are starting to make their way onto the internet today. But people who I trust and who have who love track and field as much as I do have told me, look, this building is not just going to be the best track and field stadium in the world. It's going to be one of the best stadiums and most beautiful stadiums in the world, period. So I'm looking forward to that.
That being said, you're going to be like a kid at the Willy Wonka factory for the first time when you walk in that for the Prefontaine, possibly?
I'm hoping that it gets to open with the Prefontaine or something major. I know, technically it was supposed to open with like Pac-12 championships if everything had been normal this year. For me, something that major, it needs to open with like something huge, either like a major concert or Prefontaine or the Olympic trials or Worlds. So I'm hoping that they do it justice by really having a mega opening and having it be something that really, 50 years from now, people say, the first thing that ever was here, it was something really major.
For people that don't know, my guest Otto Bolden today, he was born in Port of Spain in Trinidad and Tobago and migrated to the USA via UCLA. Yes, folks, he is a Bruin. I got to ask you, and I think we've had this conversation before, how did you get from Trinidad and Tobago to Westwood? And don't say by plane.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't a direct journey. The short version is at 14, my mother's leaving Trinidad for New York with myself and my brother. I land in Jamaica, Queens in December of 1988, freeze my behind off for an entire winter in New York, get discovered running, playing soccer on the field in 1989 by a guy called Joseph Trupiano, who's still very much a supporter of mine to this day. By 1990, I am like Queens County champion in the 200 and the 400. I wasn't running the 100 yet. And then my mother left for Atlanta, and I had to make a decision as to if I was going to follow her to Atlanta or go somewhere in my mind that where I could do my senior year of high school and where track would be a little better. And I decided to go live with my uncle in San Jose, California. So once I get to California, then I show up on John Smith's radar. He's the coach at UCLA at the time. And I meet him in 1992 in Barcelona at the Olympics, where, by the way, I had actually signed a letter of intent to go to USC.
Oh my gosh.
Exactly. And Quincy Watts, who one of the reasons why I got into the sport, I was actually carrying bags in Barcelona for Quincy Watts and Kevin Young, both of whom would win gold medals, obviously.
Quincy Watts.
So I was there being a roadie and an entourage for those guys. And John Smith said, I would like to coach you, but obviously you'd have to come to UCLA. Well, the rest is history.
That's amazing. And you did quite a good job there at UCLA. You enjoyed your time at Westwood, obviously.
I had a ball at Westwood. I never lost a single race to another collegiate athlete. UCLA was literally some of the best memories that I had in my young life. And I treasure and value those moments to this day.
When you look back on your experience in your collegiate career and what the athletes are doing now, is it a huge difference as far as training and what they're doing? Or is it similar? The groundwork is already laid and it's similar.
We know so much more now about how to get people ready to sprint. And yes, I look back at my times and I go, I ran 990 and 1980 at UCLA. Those times would still win medals in 99% of races, and they'd make every final, they'd still be competitive. But I don't know if it's like now, I look at it like, for example, a Christian Coleman who, broke the collegiate record and ran 9.82. I wasn't a 9.82 sprinter at UCLA. So there are a lot of similarities. There's still a lot of the same training going on, but I think in terms of diet and recovery and just what we know about how to get sprinters razor sharp, I think obviously they're doing a better job now, and it's why we also have better surfaces. But that's one of the reasons why you see these ridiculous times. I mean, even in high school, everybody's running much faster now.
As you look forward to, as you mentioned, 2021 in the Tokyo Olympic Games, and the absence of Usain Bolt, who do you think will be the next star to pick up the baton and run with the track and field? And who will be the sprint king of the world, do you think, coming out of Tokyo?
I think the sprint king is likely to be Christian Coleman, but Noah Lyles, you know, depending on how he looks and what he does, how good he is against Christian, I don't think there's anybody to really challenge him in the 200, unless Michael Norman steps into that 200. And Michael Norman has already said that he's running the 400 only in Tokyo. I don't think the schedule will allow for a double anyway. So for at least this Olympics, it looks like Christian Coleman in the 100 and Noah Lyles in the 200. Well, I think Noah has the more gregarious sort of personality. But if he, you know, he's talking about doing the double in the 100 and the 200. Well, if he can beat Christian or threaten Christian in 100 and then go on to win the 200, I think he may emerge as the star. But if you ask me to put put a bet on it today, I would say that the guy who emerges is Christian Coleman, because he has the potential to challenge the American record of 969 in 100.
Needless to say, USA Track and Field's feeling pretty good about sprints when you've got guys like Norman and Coleman and Lyles. I mean, that's a lot of speed, and the relays have got to be at a pretty good place with those three to choose from.
Yeah, USA Track and Field is looking at maybe an unprecedented haul of medals in the next Olympics and certainly in the next Worlds. I shouldn't say unprecedented, but we're going back to when the U.S. used to dominate almost every event, because they're so strong now in the field events. The relays, I think, have gotten it together. And then if you look carefully at what could potentially happen in Tokyo, Christian Coleman could win the 100. Noah Lyles could win the 200. They're both favored. Mike Norman could win the 400. He'd certainly be on the podium. And then you look a little higher and you go, wait a minute, Donovan Brazier is the 800-meter world champion. And that's just on the men's side. That's before we start talking about the women and how dominant they are in the hurdles and so on. So the United States are really looking very good as we look towards a cycle of Olympics, Worlds, and then Worlds again in 2023. So that's the next 3 years. And don't forget, 2024, we have another Olympics scheduled in Paris. So the next 4 years, if you're a USA Track and Field administrator, you're liking your chances and you're liking your potential medal haul.
You touched a little bit on the women's side. Kenny Harrison's a name that comes to mind, but I think a lot of people want to know, can Allison Felix muster enough strength and speed to make an impact in another year?
I don't think that it's going to be too difficult for Allison Felix to make the U.S. Olympic team. The question is in what event, because I think that's going to matter. I think if Allison runs 49 seconds, something she's done many times before, she'll make the 400 team. I think the 200-meter team is going to be a little more difficult for her to make. She didn't make the last Olympic team in 2016 at 200. But remember, she was nursing a pretty serious injury. So you can't really hold that against her. But, you know, 5 years later now, to ask Allison to come and make the 200 team, and she seems to be leaning towards the 200-meter team, I think would be, you know, a bit of an ask. But here's the bigger question. Even if she makes that team at 200 or 400, look at what's waiting for her. Because what's waiting for her in the 400 are two young women in Sawa Eid Nasser and Shawnee Miller-Weibo of the Bahamas, who just ran 48 very low.
Yeah.
Sawa Eid Nasser just ran the third fastest time ever run in the event, and she's very young. She's in her early 20s.
Early 20s, yep.
Shawnee Miller-Weibo is in her prime, and her personal best is very close to Allison Felix's in the 200, and she's over a second faster in the 400. So it's not a question of can Allison make the team. To answer your question, can Allison be a podium finisher?
Factor, yeah.
And a factor, I'm not so sure about that. I'd have to see something really, really special from her in the next year. And at her age, and not just the age, the mileage. Remember, Allison came straight out of high school and has had such a phenomenal career. She's won more medals than anybody else. I just think that's going to be difficult.
Vashti Cunningham, is this a perfect thing for her with the Olympics being pushed back a year? Did she need another year of seasoning to get herself ready? And will this be kind of a benefit for her going into 2021?
I'm not betting against Vashti because I think she has the perfect situation. I think her father has shown that despite a lot of the doubters, that she is continuing to progress. She's looked better every year. And yeah, I mean, I have the same situation with the athlete that I coach. When you have a teenager and you get another year for them to get stronger in the weight room, to understand their sport better, to mature a little bit, I just think that the sky's the limit for Vashti, and I would not be surprised to see her contend for a medal in Tokyo.
Taking it a little bit broad here with Otto Bolden here on the Announcer's Journal. Otto, you've seen so many great performances, so many world records. You've lived through the Usain Bolt regime. But when you think about track and field on a whole, who would you say is the greatest track and field athlete of all time? For my personals, I always go Jesse Owens. He's just a personal hero of mine because of what he did in Berlin at the time. But man, Usain Bolt just kind of rewrote the record books literally and figuratively.
Usain's certainly in the conversation, but I agree with you with Jesse to a certain extent. I think Jesse's the most important track and field athlete there's ever been. For me, and maybe it's because I've been watching a lot of old footage, I find it hard to not put Carl.
Oh, true.
Carl Lewis, because of those four Olympic gold medals in a row, in the long jump, plus what he did on the track, plus what he did in terms of dragging the sport out of the doldrums of amateurism. Those three are in my top three, Jesse and Bolt and Carl. But I think if you ask me to pick one, the greatest, I think Carl's still the greatest. I was the first person to say that Bolt's the greatest sprinter, and there's not even, I don't even think it's close. But in terms of greatest track and field athlete, certainly on the men's side, I think I still go with Carl.
Seeing Usain Bolt run live, and I've told many people this, it's odd looking because he's so tall. He's such an amazing athlete. But when he runs, it's like gazelle-like. And we've seen him many times when he has a race won, it looks like he's backing down. He's looking over, he's smiling like we saw in Rio and things like that. And you think, no, Usain, put your head down and power through the line, because I just wonder what he could have done had he not had that kind of Jamaican free spirit the last 5 meters.
Yeah, and the more I go back and look at some of these races, all of which I called, and some of which are just his iconic moments, you go, oh my gosh, he really didn't run through the tape. And I don't just mean the obvious one. Everybody remembers the Beijing race because it was such a rapid deceleration. It was such a memorable celebration. That 9.69 that he runs in Beijing beating his chest, I don't know if I remember in real time saying, hey, he possibly threw away a 9.59. I think it's faster, and it's because now as a coach, I remember certain things about when you celebrate like that.
Right.
When you see somebody celebrate at 10 meters to go, maybe, he did it at 20. But when you see somebody celebrate at 10, they have to start thinking about it 10 meters before, because remember the rate at which you're moving. So for me, in Beijing, he starts to think about that, about the celebration, maybe at 75 meters into the race. That's just nuts. And then I go back and I look at the London race, which you probably alluded to, and you think, oh yeah, he ran 9.63 there. That's his second fastest time. But guess what? He didn't run through the line.
No.
He kind of looked over to see where Blake was. And once he had cleared Blake, it was like, oh, I got it. Ditto that for so many other races. The London 2012 200, which, he ran 19, I believe, 32 in that race. That's his third fastest 200. But it probably should have been 19.2 something. So I agree with you. There's so many of his races I go back now and I go, oh man, that's his second or his third best time. And he didn't, that wasn't a maximum effort. So I don't know if he looks back at it like that and thinks that. He probably thinks, look, man, I have all the fastest times, I have all the medals. But for me as a stat guy and as a purist and as a real fan of the sport, I can't help but look at some of those and go, oh man, that could have been better.
And as a competitor, someone who's won Olympic medals before, if you're someone like Johan Blake and you see Usain Bolt looking over, I mean, you sense what he's doing and he's looking over at you with a big smile on his face. You're thinking, are you kidding me? And he's got a stride on you. What's that got to be like?
Yeah, I know. In terms of what you're saying, I think of his celebration in London 2012 as he puts his fingers to his lips right, as if to say shh when he comes across the line in 2012. And I realized that, yeah, he was training partners and he was friends with Johan Blake. But I think now that we sort of understand that he and Johan weren't as close as we thought, and there was a little bit of animosity mm-hmm. there. And now I don't think he and Johan even speak, and there's a whole big rift with the coach. I think a lot of that was it wasn't just directed towards the media or towards fans who were doubting him. I think a little bit of that was towards Johan, where he was kind of saying, hey, I know you think that you're the heir to the throne
exactly.
and I'm dead. Just so you know, I'm not dead yet and I'm not going anywhere. So it's funny to be able to go back, you know, 8 years and look at that Olympic Games and go, ooh, wait a minute. You know what? I look at that sort of gesture differently now.
For someone that's never been in a stadium, the feeling is so different. Watching it on TV, the networks of NBC, it's great. And you see it, and the angles are fantastic, and we cover it with every kind of possible angle, blimps, side cameras, everything. But there's something about being in the stadium, whether it was in Rio or whatever, and seeing that 100 and lineup and the chill. I mean, it's like a heavyweight bout. When they come to the blocks and they go set, take us inside the announcer's booth for you. What's your job and what are you thinking and what are you looking at?
It's not just, I mean, you're right. The minutes and the seconds and the moments leading up to when that gun fires is unlike anything else that I've experienced. I've been to NBA finals. I've been to
Super Bowls.
Yep. I've been to just about everything. Because it is so short and because it requires such silence before mm-hmm. the action happens, I think it's a very unique moment. For me, it's not just about those moments and those minutes. The entire day is different for me because for me, I can't tell my brain that I'm not running. So I get that. I have that experience when it's a big day for my athlete. I have that experience when it's a big day in the broadcast booth. I don't sleep well the night before. I get up with jitters and yeah. nerves, and I'm like, hey, you're not running. But for me, I am nervous because the challenge is you have to be great, right? It's not just that I'm calling the 100-meter final and I can have an okay night. I have to be absolutely prepared. I know that this call is going to exist on tape and online. Yeah. Forever. There's a lot of pressure in that. And it's why for me, I tell people all the time, my 2008 Beijing Olympic calls, every one of them was scripted. Every single one. I knew Bolt would win. I knew he'd win by a lot. Maybe I didn't think he was going to win by whatever it was, 7-8 meters and have that massacre happen at the end of that race. But when Sam Flood, our producer at the time, so beautifully lines up the video with my audio, the reason why my audio is good is not because as a first-time Olympic broadcaster, I'm that astute and that sharp. It's because I had sort of taken a guess as to what the race would look like, and I'd already written it. The 100-meter dash is running a straight line, but ladies and gentlemen, Usain Bolt has turned the corner. I wrote that 3 months ago in my office. So for me, when I get into that booth, I am trying to relax the same way that the sprinters are. It's like, listen, don't, this is not about you. You need to compliment the moment and put it in perspective, but let the video do the talking. Don't mm-hmm. over-talk after they cross the line. Don't talk over the beautiful visuals that NBC is going to put out there on the air. But I feel a lot of pressure, and it has nothing to do with, you know, I have an athlete, you know, that I want to do well, or right. I care who wins. It's about you have to be as great as the moment. And for me, that always has sort of rushed me back to make sure you're 100% prepared. No matter what happens in this race, lanes 1 through 8, 2 through 9, wherever they're configured to run, you make sure that you can be as good as this moment. Because quite frankly, I don't know if I am still working at NBC if I drop the ball in Beijing. They'd have found somebody else.
I don't know. And I know you wouldn't drop the ball either. So looking ahead, though, your future, I mean, NBC is going to be wanting to keep you on through however long we have the Olympics, which I think is to the, into the 30s or whatever. You've had a past life of dabbling in politics. And we've talked about this before. Is that something you think about getting back into either here in the States, your adopted home country, or back in your real home country of Trinidad and Tobago?
I got a chance to represent NBC Sports Engine and NBC last year, speaking to Congress. I really like it. I realize that, you know, I've always been into politics. Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who, if you go and turn on my television right now, it's on all the news channels. Right. I eat that stuff up. Like, election night for me is great. I've always been interested in politics. My foray into politics in Trinidad was really because I was asked by somebody who I respect. And I really felt like I went in, and we weren't in power. The party that I joined was in opposition. We'd be like the Democrats right now.
Right.
And I got in there and I was so disillusioned by what I met. I just went, oh no, this is not how I want to be involved in my homeland. And this is not what I want to contribute. And this is not what I want my legacy to be. And I got out. I was gone in like 14 months. And that's actually when I started broadcasting. But there have since been a couple guys who are not career politicians, guys who are entertainers and TV and radio guys who have gone in there. And I'm like, you know what? More power to them. If that's what you think you want to have a contribution to your country as, then by all means, go and do it. But for me, I think it would take a really unique and special invitation or opportunity for me to go back there. I just feel like there are other ways that I can contribute without getting sort of stuck in that political vehicle.
So you're saying there's a chance. Folks, you hear it here first on the Announcers Journal. Otto Bold in 2024. Get out the vote. I know another one of your great passions that we both share is the movie Coming to America, and supposedly a sequel's coming out, and there's got to be a way that we all get together, you, myself, Lewis Johnson, Jack Felling, Rob Hyland, the list goes on and on. We got to be there with a bucket of popcorn and a root beer and watching that show. Give me the insight, because I know you got a little bit of your toes just a little bit in Hollywood. What are you hearing? Is this going to happen, Coming to America 2?
Coming to America wrapped months ago. It's already done and ready. But of course, are movie theaters going to be a thing anymore? Because yeah. I'm not so sure they are. I think we're headed to some sort of a direct to your home theater kind of deal. But yeah, I mean, I have, you know, what's funny, I think for me with that movie is that Coming to America is an immigrant who travels to America. Well, he's not an immigrant, but he's a visitor to America, yeah, trying to find something. And in a lot of ways, that was me, especially back in the 80s. So I think that movie always resonated with me because when I came to the United States and to New York, obviously, and to Queens, by the way.
Exactly.
Right? Because if you're gonna go find your queen,
you gotta go to Queens.
Right. So for me, I think that movie always resonated because there's so many elements in that movie, particularly in the first half of it, where you don't understand when you're born and raised in a different country and then you show up to New York in the winter, it is such a shock, not just the weather, it's a culture shock. It's the noise level. Everything is different. You really feel like this literal fish out of water. So, I mean, I hope and pray that we can get together and watch that movie. But I see a lot of the studios that are looking to just get that stuff out and get it out directly to the fans and to the consumers. They're not going to wait until the movie industry recovers, because the movie industry may not recover. I believe it's one of those major movie theater chains is already on the brink of bankruptcy. So we'll see.
Otto, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I want you to stay healthy, stay happy, keep training when you can, and please let me know when Coming to America 2 comes out, because I will fly to Florida and watch it with you, because it would be worth it to me.
It's a deal, man. Absolutely. Great to talk to you.
Take care, Otto. That's Otto Bolden here on the Announcers Journal, the four-time Olympic medalist, one of the all-time great announcers that NBC has at their disposal for track and field. That'll do it for another edition of the Announcers Journal. I'm Todd Harris. We'll see you next time. Stay safe, everybody.